I want you to cast your minds back to the earlier period, BC, before COVID. The pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong, it was, well, like everything else, silent somewhat in the isolation of the pandemic. But in spite of the COVID-19 shutdown of Hong Kong, pro-democracy demonstrations and demonstrators first began to reappear on the streets and the shopping malls from the 1st of May, Labor Day. Now, they didn't want authorities to forget, clearly, that the movement which began in protest last June had gone away. You'll recall, initially, demonstrators were opposing the extradition bill, remember this way back, that would have allowed detainees in Hong Kong to be transferred to mainland China. Now, that bill was withdrawn, but the pro-democracy movement, its leaders, saw no reason to stop. The sharp political divisions left after that, and in Hong Kong's Legislative Council, they began to play out last week. And it manifested in actual physical violence between lawmakers and security guards in that council. Anthony Dapperin is a lawyer. He's the author of City of Protest, A Recent History of Dissent in Hong Kong. And he's something of an LNL regular. He joins us from Hong Kong. Anthony, welcome back.
Good evening, Jonathan.
Those violent spats in the Legislative Council, what was that? That was about criminalising abuse of the Chinese national anthem, which often cops booze, apparently.
Yes, that's right. Beginning a couple of years ago, people in Hong Kong decided they would start booing the Chinese national anthem when it was played at football matches in particular here in Hong Kong as a way of expressing their discontent with Beijing. And this was something that Beijing wasn't too happy with. And they decided the solution to that problem was to introduce a law which would make it a criminal offence to disrespect or insult the national anthem, punishable with a jail sentence of up to 3 years. And that bill has been sitting on the books waiting to be presented to Hong Kong's legislature. And that is what has led to these physical spats in our Legislative Council over the last week or so, as the pro-Beijing parties have tried to push that, get themselves into a position to be able to push that bill through.
China seems determined on provocation.
Yes, I mean, it is a very strange approach that they're taking, especially when you look at times like, for example, the district council elections we had last year, when democracy was a very effective way of reducing the pressures and going some way to assuaging public opinion. But yet Beijing seems intent on cracking down on Hong Kong, on silencing any kind of dissent, and really bringing Hong Kong to heel by the most coercive means at its disposal.
The national anthem bill is the specific, but this issue goes directly to who controls the house where bills are scrutinised, who gets to chair the house committee in Hong Kong.
That's right. So by a sort of an odd procedural technicality, the chair position was vacated and there needs to be a re-election of a new chair before effectively legislative business can resume in the council. And so there had been a pro-democracy legislator had temporarily been holding that chair position, supposedly until a new chair was elected. But he had used the opportunity that this presented to effectively, together with his pro-democracy colleagues, filibuster that whole process. And so the Legislative Council and the entire legislative process in Hong Kong had been drawn to a halt. And bearing in mind, we have elections coming up for our parliament in September this year. So if they could drag that filibuster out until the summer, they would then be able to have the national anthem bill taken off the books entirely and have that process relaunched. So in order to deal with this, what the pro-Beijing parties did to regain control was really a combination, really typical of Beijing's playbook, a combination of using the law and using brute physical force. So they firstly, the pro-Beijing politicians obtained a supportive legal opinion from a friendly QC telling them that they could have find a legal basis for them to take the chair of this committee. And then together with the support of the security guards in the Legislative Council, effectively muscled their way physically into the chairman's seat. And if you look at the video of this incident, it's quite remarkable to behold. A full half hour before the committee was due to commence, a whole phalanx of Legislative Council security guards effectively shepherded the pro-Beijing legislator through a crowd of democratic legislators, almost like it was a rugby match or an Aussie rules football match.
Just walk us through that sequence of events, because it's a fairly extraordinary little chronology.
It was. So the legislators were all sitting in the council chamber waiting for the committee meeting to start, and we're expecting that the pro-democracy legislator would be taking his spot in the chair once again, as he had been for the previous months. But half an hour before the meeting was due to begin, the pro-Beijing claimant to the chair suddenly marched into the room, surrounded by a phalanx of Legislative Council security guards, and started approaching the chair's seat. As soon as the Democratic legislators saw what was going on, they leapt up from their seats and tried to rush across the chamber to stop her getting into the chairman's seat. But the Legislative Council guards managed to physically shepherd them away, as I said, like an Aussie rules match, and enabled the pro-Beijing legislator to muscle her way physically into the chairman's seat. And then the security guards formed a physical screen to prevent the Democratic legislators from getting their way to the chairman's seat. And then she proceeded to chair the meeting. And the Democratic legislators were one by one physically carried from the chamber supposedly for the disorder that they were causing. And as a result of this sequence of events, the pro-Beijing legislators managed to win back control of this committee, and that's how they've managed to get proceedings back on track and be presenting the National Anthem Bill next week for consideration.
As you say, a combination of democracy and brute force, but a pretty emphatic demonstration about who's really in charge here.
Yes, and really the aiding and abetting of the Legislative Council security guards was something that didn't go unnoticed, and people really thought that the partisanship that this supposedly neutral body was showing was really quite remarkable. And some of the footage of the way they were physically dragging these pro-democracy legislators out of the chamber was really quite shocking, and a few of the pro-democracy legislators ended up in hospital. But there are other remarkable scenes, like one pro-democracy legislator, Eddie Chu, trying to scale the walls at the back of the chamber to sort of climb over the security guards to try and get to the chairman's seat himself. So it was really really a free-for-all.
What happens subsequently? I mean, will the pro-democracy legislators just cop that on the chin, or could we see even parallel meetings of legislators or rival chairs?
Yeah, there was parallel meetings were one possibility of being threatened, but the other thing they could do in theory is take the Legislative Council president to judicial review, to the courts, to have his decision to allow this to go ahead to be reviewed by the courts. But of course, that all takes time, and by the time that judicial review process happens, the legislative process is likely to be done and dusted. So in a way, they have their hands tied. It's also important to remember that as a result of a sort of structural gerrymander of the legislature here, that the pro-democracy legislators are in a minority. So effectively, the pro-Beijing parties in the end can do what they want. And so this role of protesting from within the legislative chamber is sort of the only effective thing the pro-democracy legislators can do at this point.
Out of the legislative chamber and into the justice system, and there's evidence, is there not, to suggest that pro-democracy demonstrators are not getting a fair shake in that system compared to pro-Beijing supporters that have also come into contact with the law?
Yes. Now, the Hong Kong government has always talked about the importance of the rule of law, and something that everyone agrees is a universal value. But unfortunately, the way they are applying it is not evenly handed, and there's emerged a clear pattern of the prosecutors in the Department of Justice applying really the full force of the law and asking for the harsher sentences for protesters and pro-democracy defendants, whereas if there are people sort of on the government side, they tend to receive more lenient treatment. And this was really thrown into stark relief last week when we had a young protester, a 21-year-old lifeguard who had been involved in one of the protests in June last year, charged with rioting, and he'd been captured on video footage throwing yellow plastic hard hats and other objects at the police line. And he was sentenced to 4 years jail, 48 months jail for riot for that. And people were comparing that to another sentence that a pro-Beijing or a pro-government offender received just a week earlier. He had, in a premeditated attack, taken a number of knives to a what we call a Lenin Wall, a site in the suburbs of Hong Kong where people post pro-democracy posters and slogans and so on, attacked three people with these knives at the Lenin Wall, hospitalizing three of them, one of them critically injured in a really very serious and violent attack. He received only 45 months jail, 3 months less than the young lifeguard for rioting. And people couldn't help comparing the sentences here, that someone who, in a premeditated attack that could clearly be characterized as attempted murder, although he wasn't charged with that, receiving a lesser sentence than a protester who hadn't apparently injured anyone seriously at all.
June 4, Anthony, that looms as the next flashpoint, presumably the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre?
Yes, that's right. And traditionally, June 4 has been marked every year in Hong Kong with a candlelight vigil in Victoria Park, a very large event attended by often upwards of 100,000 people. But of course, we have the coronavirus social distancing restrictions currently in force. And then just yesterday, the government announced that notwithstanding we have almost no local infections at the moment in Hong Kong, those social distancing measures will be extended as follows. And it's kind of interesting. Temples, churches, mosques, and other places of worship will be allowed to reopen for public gatherings this Friday. Places like karaoke parlors and nightclubs will be allowed to open at the end of May, but large public gatherings in excess of 8 people won't be allowed until, guess the date, 4th of June. So they've just very carefully extended those bans exactly until the day that the Tiananmen vigil would be held, and as a result, that vigil won't be going ahead, and for the first time, the Tiananmen Square massacre won't be marked by a public event in Hong Kong since 1989.
On that coronavirus question, I mean, it's a remarkable story in Hong Kong. The performance has been, just over 1,000 cases and 4 deaths. That's quite extraordinary.
Yes, it is. And it's been a combination of two things. I think that, to be fair, that the government has done a good job in terms of testing and contact tracing and quarantine and so on to stop the spread of the virus through the community reasonably effectively. But also we have a very high community awareness of infectious diseases in Hong Kong as a result of the SARS outbreak here back in 2003. So from back in January, people were wearing masks, being very careful about going out, and there was a very high degree of awareness, which is now reflected in the community perceptions of who should be taking the credit for Hong Kong's performance, and also reflects a sort of the breakdown in trust of the Hong Kong government after the protest last year, that Hong Kongers have been surveyed and overwhelmingly credit themselves and credit civil society and our free press and the ability of our medical practitioners to speak out freely for Hong Kong's excellent performance, and the government gets less kudos from the community, at least for their role in containing the virus.
It seems there's no issue in Hong Kong that doesn't carry that political edge.
Absolutely, yes. It really has become a highly politicized, a highly politically charged atmosphere here.
Anthony, thank you. And look, I imagine that the events around the 4th of June will bear examination. We'll keep an eye out.
Yes, and we have some other significant anniversaries of last year's protest events coming up after that, so there'll be more flashpoints to come, I'm sure.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Anthony Dapperin, he's a lawyer, author of City of Protest, and that's published by Penguin.